Gordon Grove, clean-shaven, stout and sweating. The High Septon, a frail man with wispy white chin hair. Too many strange faces, Tyrion thought. Too many new players. The game changed while I lay rotting in my bed, and no one will tell me the rules. Oh, the lords were courteous enough, though he could tell how uncomfortable it made them to look at him. And that chain of yours, that was cunning, Mace Tyrell had said in a jolly tone, and Lord Redwine nodded and said, quite so, my lord of Irongarden speaks for all of us, and very cheerfully too. Tell it to the people of the city, Tyrion thought bitterly. Tell it to the bloody singers with their songs of Renly's ghost. His uncle Kevin had been the warmest, going so far as to kiss his cheek and saying, Lancel has told me how brave you were, Tyrion. He speaks very highly of you. He'd better, or I'll have a few things to say of him. He made himself smile and say, my good cousin is too kind. His wound is healing, I trust. Sir Kevin frowned. One day seems stronger, the next, well, it is worrisome. Your sister often visits his sick bed to lift his spirits and pray for him. But is she praying that he lives or dies? Cersei had made shameless use of their cousin, both in and out of bed. A little secret she no doubt hoped Lancel would carry to his grave, now that father was here and she no longer had need of him. Would she go so far as to murder him, though? To look at her today, you would never suspect Cersei was capable of such ruthlessness. She was all charm, flirting with Lord Tyrell as they spoke of Joffrey's wedding feast, complimenting Lord Redwine on the valour of his twins, softening gruff Lord Rowan with jests and smiles, making pious noises at the High Septon. "Shall we begin with the wedding arrangements?" she asked, as Lord Tywin took his seat. "No," their father said, "with the war, Varys." The eunuch smiled a silken smile. "I have such delicious things for you all, my lords. Yesterday at dawn, our brave Lord Randall caught Robert Glover outside Duskendale and trapped him against the sea. Losses were heavy on both sides, but in the end our loyal men prevailed. Sir Helmund Tallheart is reported dead with 1,000 others. Robert Glover leads the survivors back toward Harrenhal in bloody disarray, little dreaming he will find valiant Sir Gregor and his stalwarts athwart his path. Guards be praised, said Paxter Redwine, a great victory for King Joffrey. What did Joffrey have to do with it? Thought Tyrion. And a terrible defeat for the North, certainly, observed Littlefinger, yet one in which Robb Stark played no part. The young wolf remains unbeaten in the field. What do we know of Stark's plans and movements? Asked Mathis Rowan, ever blunt and to the point. He has run back to River Run with his plunder, abandoning the castles he took in the west, announced Lord Tywin. Our cousin, Sir Davin, is reforming the remnants of his late father's army at Lannisport. When they are ready, he shall join Sir Fawley Prester at the Golden Tooth. As soon as the Stark boy starts north, Sir Fawley and Sir Davin will descend on River Run.
You are certain Lord Stark means to go north? Lord Rowan asked. Even with the Iron Men at Moat Cailin?
Mace Tyrell spoke up.
Is there anything as pointless as a king without a kingdom? No, it's plain the boy must abandon the Riverlands, join his forces to Roose Bolton's once more, and throw all his strength against Moat Cailin. That is what I would do.
Tyrion had to bite his tongue at that. Robb Stark had won more battles in a year than the Lord of Highgarden had in 20. Tyrell's reputation rested on one indecisive victory over Robert Baratheon at Ashford, in a battle largely won by Lord Tarly's van before the main host had even arrived. The siege of Storm's End, where Mace Tyrell actually did hold the command, had dragged on a year to no result, and after the Trident was fought, the Lord of Highgarden had meekly dipped his banners to Eddard Stark. "I ought to write Rob Stark a stern letter," Littlefinger was saying. "I understand his man Bolton is stabling goats in my high hall. It's really quite unconscionable." Sir Kevin Lannister cleared his throat. "As regards the Starks, Balon Greyjoy, who now stars himself King of the Isles and the North, has written to us offering terms of alliance." "He ought to be offering fealty," snapped Cersei. "By what right does he call himself king?" "By right of conquest," Lord Tyrion said. "King Balon has strangler's fingers around the neck. Robb Stark's heirs are dead. Winterfell is fallen. And the Iron Men hold Moat Cailin, Deepwood Mott, and most of the Stony Shore. King Balon's longships command the Sunset Sea and are well placed to menace Lennisport, Fair Isle, and even Highgarden, or should we provoke him?"
"And if we accept this alliance," inquired Lord Mathisruan, "what terms does he propose?"
"That we recognize his kingship and grant him everything north of the neck."
Lord Redwine laughed.
What is there north of the neck that any sane man would want? If Greyjoy will trade swords and sails for stone and snow, I say do it, and count ourselves lucky."
"Truly," agreed Mace Tyrell, "that's what I would do. Let King Balon finish the Northmen whilst we finish Stannis."
Lord Tywin's face gave no hint as to his feelings.
"There is Lysa Arryn to deal with as well. John Arryn's widow, Hoster Tully's daughter, Catelyn Stark's sister, whose husband was conspiring with Stannis Baratheon at the time of his death."
"Oh," said Mace Tyrell cheerfully, "women have no stomach for war. Let her be, I say. She's not like to trouble us."
"I agree," said Redwine. "The Lady Lysa took no part in the fighting, nor has she committed any overt acts of treason."
Tyrion stirred.
"She did throw me in a cell and put me on trial for my life," he pointed out, with a certain amount of rancor. "Nor has she returned to King's Landing to swear fealty to Joff, as she was commanded. My lords, grant me the men, and I will sort out Lysa Arryn."
He could think of nothing he would enjoy more, except perhaps strangling Cersei. Sometimes he still dreamed of the airy sky cells and woke drenched in cold sweat. Mace Tyrell's smile was jovial, but behind it Tyrion sensed contempt.
"Perhaps you'd best leave the fighting to fighters," said the Lord of Highgarden. "Better men than you have lost great armies in the Mountains of the Moon, or shattered them against the Bloody Gate. We know your worth, my lord. No need to tempt fate."
Tyrion pushed off his cushions, bristling, but his father spoke before he could lash back.
"I have other tasks in mind for Tyrion. I believe Lord Petar may hold the key to the Eyrie."
"Oh, I do," said Littlefinger. "I have it here between my legs." There was mischief in his grey-green eyes. "My lords, with your leave, I propose to travel to the Vale and there woo and win Lady Lysa Arryn. Once I am her consort, I shall deliver you the Vale of Arryn without a drop of blood being spilled."
Lord Rowan looked doubtful. "Would Lady Lysa have you?"
She's had me a few times before, Lord Mathis, and voiced no complaints.
"Bedding," said Cersei, "is not wedding. Even a cow like Lysa Arryn might be able to grasp the difference."
"To be sure, it would not have been fitting for a daughter of Riverrun to marry one so far below her."
Littlefinger spread his hands.
"Now, though, a match between the Lady of the Eyrie and the Lord of Harrenhal is not so unthinkable, is it?"
Tyrion noted the look that passed between Paxter Redwine and Mace Tyrell.
"It might serve," Lord Rowan said, "if you are certain that you can keep the woman loyal to the king's grace."
"My lords," pronounced the High Septon, "autumn is upon us. and all men of good heart are weary of war. If Lord Baelish can bring the veil back into the king's peace, without more shedding of blood, the gods will surely bless him.
But can he? Asked Lord Redwine. John Aaron's son is Lord of the Airy now, the Lord Robert.
Only a boy, said Littlefinger. I will see that he grows to be Joffrey's most loyal subject, and a fast friend to us all.
Tyrion studied the slender man with a pointed beard and irreverent grey-green eyes.
Lord of Arinal, an empty honour? Bugger that, father. Even if he never sets foot in the castle, the title makes this match possible, as he's known all along.
We have no lack of foes, said Sir Kevin Lannister. If the area can be kept out of the war, all to the good. I am of a mind to see what Lord Petar can accomplish.
Sir Kevin was his brother's vanguard in council. Tyrion knew from long experience he had never had a thought that Lord Tywin had not had first.
It has all been settled beforehand, he concluded, and this discussion no more than show.
The sheep were bleating their agreement, unaware of how neatly they'd been shorn. So it fell to Tyrion to object.
How will the crown pay its debts without Lord Petaia? He is our wizard of coin, and we have no one to replace him.
Littlefinger smiled.
Oh, my little friend is too kind. All I do is count coppers, as King Robert used to say. Any clever tradesman can do as well, and a Lannister, blessed with a golden touch of castly rock, will no doubt far surpass me.
A Lannister?
Tyrion had a bad feeling about this. Lord Tywin's gold-flecked eyes met his son's mismatched ones.
You are admirably suited to the task, I believe.
Indeed, Sir Kevin said heartily. I've no doubt you'll make a splendid master of coin, Tyrion. Lord Tywin turned back to Littlefinger.
If Lysa Aaron will take you for a husband and return to the king's peace, we shall restore the Lord Robert to the honour of Warden of the East. How soon might you leave?
On the morrow, if the winds permit. There's a Bravassi galley standing out past the chain, taking on cargo by boat. The Merlin King. I'll see her captain about a berth.
You will miss the king's wedding, said Mace Tyrell.
Petaia Baelish gave a shrug. Tides and brides wait on no man, my lord. Once the autumn storms begin, the voyage will be much more hazardous. Drowning would definitely diminish my charms as a bridegroom.
Lord Tyrell chuckled. True. Best you do not linger. May the gods speed you on your way, the High Septon said. All King's Landing shall pray for your success.
Lord Redwine pinched at his nose.
May we return to the matter of the Greyjoy Alliance. In my view, there is much to be said for it. Greyjoy's longships will augment my own fleet, and give us sufficient strength at sea to assault Dragonstone and end Stannis Baratheon's pretensions.
King Balon's longships are occupied for the nonce, Lord Tywin said politely. As are we. Greyjoy demands half the kingdom as the price of alliance, but what will he do to earn it? Fight the Starks? He's doing that already. Why should we pay for what he has given us free? The best thing to do about our Lord of Pike is nothing, in my view. Granted enough time, a better option may present itself, one that does not require the king to give up half his kingdom.
Tyrion watched his father closely.
There's something he's not saying.
He remembered those important letters Lord Tywin had been writing, the night Tyrion had demanded Casterly Rock.
What was it he said? Some battles are won with swords and spears, others with quills and ravens.
He wondered who the better option was, and what sort of price he was demanding.
Perhaps we ought to move on to the wedding, Sir Kevin said. The High Septon spoke of the preparations being made at the Great Sept of Baelor, and Cersei detailed the plans she had been making for the feast. They would feed 1,000 in the throne room, but many more outside in the yards. The outer and middle wards would be tented in silk, with tables of food and casks of ale for all those who could not be accommodated within the hall.
"Your Grace," said Grand Maester Pycelle, "in regard to the number of guests, we have had a raven from Sunspear. 300 Dornish men are riding toward King's Landing as we speak, and hope to arrive before the wedding."
"How do they come?" asked Mace Tyrell gruffly. "They have not asked leave to cross my lands."
His thick neck had turned a dark red, Tyrion noted. Dornishmen and high gardeners had never had great love for one another. Over the centuries they had fought border wars beyond count, and raided back and forth across mountains and marches, even when at peace. The enmity had waned a bit after Dorn had become part of the Seven Kingdoms, until the Dornish prince they called the Red Viper had crippled the young heir of Highgarden in a tourney. This could be ticklish, the dwarf thought, waiting to see how his father would handle it.
"Prince Doran comes at my son's invitation," Lord Tywin said calmly, "not only to join in our celebration, but to claim his seat on this council, and the justice Robert denied him for the murder of his sister Elia and her children."
Tyrion watched the faces of the Lords Tyrell, Redwine, and Rowan, wondering if any of the three would be bold enough to say, "But Lord Tywin, wasn't it you who presented the bodies to Robert, all wrapped up in Lannister cloaks?" None of them did, but it was there on their faces all the same. "Redwine does not give a fig," he thought, "but Rowan looks fit to gag." "When the king is wed to your Margaery, and Marcella to Prince Tristane, we shall all be one great house," Sir Kevin reminded Mace Tyrell. "The enmities of the past should remain there. Would you not agree, my lord?"
"This is my daughter's wedding."
"And my grandson's," said Lord Tywin firmly. "No place for old quarrel, surely."
"I have no quarrel with Dorin, Martell," insisted Lord Tyrell, though his tone was more than a little grudging. "If he wishes to cross the Reach in peace, he need only ask my leave."
"Small chance of that," thought Tyrion. "He'll climb the Boneway, turn east near Summerhall, and come up the King's Road."
300 Dornishmen need not trouble our plans," said Cersei. "We can feed the men-at-arms in the yard, squeeze some extra benches into the throne room for the lordlings and highborn knights, and find Prince Doran a place of honour on the dais."
"Not by me," was a message Tyrion read in Mace Tyrell's eyes, but the Lord of Highgarden made no reply but a curt nod.
"Perhaps we can move to a more pleasant task," said Lord Tywin. "The fruits of victory await division."
"What could be sweeter?" said Littlefinger, who had already swallowed his own fruit, Harrenhal. Each lord had his own demands. This castle and that village, tracts of lands, a small river, a forest, the wardship of certain miners left fatherless by the battle. Fortunately, these fruits were plentiful, and there were orphans and castles for all. Varys had lists. 47 lesser lordlings and 619 knights had lost their lives beneath the fiery heart of Stannis and his Lord of Light, along with several thousand common men-at-arms. Traitors all, their heirs were disinherited, their lands and castles granted to those who had proved more loyal. Highgarden reaped the richest harvest. Tyrion eyed Mace Tyrell's broad belly and thought, "He has a prodigious appetite, this one." Tyrell demanded the lands and castles of Lord Alistair Florent, his own bannerman, who'd had the singular ill-judgment to back first Renly and then Stannis. Lord Tywin was pleased to oblige. Brightwater Keep
and all its lands and incomes were granted to Lord Tyrell's second son, Sir Garlon, transforming him into a great lord in the blink of an eye. His elder brother, of course, stood to inherit Highgarden itself. Lesser tracts were granted to Lord Rowan and set aside for Lord Tarley, Lady Oakheart, Lord Hightower, and other worthies not present. Lord Redwine asked only for 30 years' remission of the taxes that Littlefinger and his wine factors had levied on certain of the Arbor's finest vintages. When that was granted, he pronounced himself well satisfied and suggested that they send for a cask of Arbor gold to toast good King Joffrey and his wise and benevolent hand. At that, Cersei lost patience. "It's swords Joff needs, not toasts," she snapped. "His realm is still plagued with would-be usurpers and self-styled kings."
"But not for long, I think," said Varys anxiously.
"A few more items remain, my lords." Sir Kevin consulted his papers. "Sir Adam has found some crystals from the High Septon's crown. It appears now that the thieves broke up the crystals and melted down the gold.
Our father above knows their guilt, and will sit in judgment on them all," the High Septon said piously. "No doubt he will," said Lord Tywin. "All the same, you must be crowned at the king's wedding. Cersei, summon your goldsmiths. We must see to a replacement."
He did not wait for her reply, but turned at once to Varys.
"You have reports?"
The eunuch drew a parchment from his sleeve.
A kraken has been seen off the fingers," he giggled. Not a grey joy, mind you, a true kraken. It attacked an Ebony's whaler and pulled it under. There is fighting on the stepstones, and a new war between Tyrosh and Lys seems likely. Both hope to win Myr as ally. Sailors back from the Jade Sea report that a three-headed dragon has hatched in Karth and is the wonder of that city."
"Dragons and krakens do not interest me, regardless of the number of their heads," said Lord Tywin. "Have your whisperers perchance found some trace of my brother's son?"
"Alas, our beloved Tyrek has quite vanished. The poor, brave lad."
Varys sounded close to tears. "Tywin," Sir Kevin said before Lord Tywin could vent his obvious displeasure, "some of the gold cloaks who deserted during the battle have drifted back to barracks, thinking to take up duty once again. Sir Adam wishes to know what to do with them." "They might have endangered Joff with their cowardice," Cersei said at once. "I want them put to death." Varys sighed.
"They have surely earned death, Your Grace. None can deny it, and yet perhaps we might be wiser to send them to the Night's Watch. We have had disturbing messages from the Wall of late, of wildlings astir."
"Wildlings? Krakens and dragons?" Mace Tyrell chuckled. "Why, is there anyone not stirring?"
Lord Tywin ignored that.
"The deserters serve us better as a lesson. Break their knees with hammers. They will not run again, nor will any man who sees them begging in the streets."
He glanced down the table to see if any of the other lords disagreed. Tyrion remembered his own visit to the Wall, and the crabs he'd shared with old Lord Mormont and his officers. He remembered the old bear's fears as well.
"Perhaps we might break the knees of a few to make our point. Those who kill Sir Jocelyn, say. The rest we can send to Marsh. The watch is grievously under strength. If the Wall should fail,
the wildlings will flood the north," his father finished. "And the Starks and Greyjoys will have another enemy to contend with. They no longer wish to be subject to the Iron Throne, it would seem. So by what right do they look to the Iron Throne for aid? King Robb and King Balin both claim the North. Let them defend it, if they can. And if not, this Mance Raider might even prove a useful ally. Lord Tywin looked to his brother. "Is there more?" Sir Kevin shook his head. "We are done. My lords, His Grace King Joffrey would no doubt wish to thank you all for your wisdom and good counsel."
"I should like private words with my children," said Lord Tywin, as the others rose to leave. "You as well, Kevin."
Obediently, the other councillors made their farewells, Varys the first to depart, and Tyrell and Redwine the last. When the chamber was empty but for the four Lannisters, Sir Kevin closed the door.
"Master of Coin," said Tyrion, in a thin, strained voice, "whose notion was that, pray?"
"Lord Petyr's," his father said. "But it serves us well to have the treasury in the hands of a Lannister. You have asked for important work. Do you fear you might be incapable of the task?"
"No," said Tyrion.
"I fear a trap. Littlefinger is subtle and ambitious. I do not trust him, nor should you."
"He won Highgarden to our side," Cersei began.
"And sold you Ned Stark, I know. He will sell us just as quick. A coin is as dangerous as a sword in the wrong hands."
His uncle Kevin looked at him oddly. "Not to us, surely. The gold of Castle Rock
is dug from the ground. Littlefinger's gold is made from thin air, with a snap of his fingers."
"A more useful skill than any of yours, sweet brother," purred Cersei, in a voice sweet with malice. "Littlefinger is a liar."
"And black as well," said the raven of the crow.
Lord Tywin slammed his hand down on the table.
"Enough. I will have no more of this unseemly squabbling. You are both Lannisters, and will comport yourself as such."
Sir Kevin cleared his throat.
"I would sooner have Petyr Baelish ruling the Eyrie than any of Lady Lysa's other suitors, Yon Royce, Lynn Corbray, Horton Redford. These are dangerous men, each in his own way, and proud.
Littlefinger may be clever, but he is neither high birth nor skill at arms. The Lords of the Vale will never accept such as their liege." He looked to his brother. When Lord Tywin nodded, he continued, "And there is this. Lord Petyr continues to demonstrate his loyalty. Only yesterday he brought us word of a Tyrell plot to spirit Sansa Stark off to Highgarden for a visit, and there marry her to Lord Mace's eldest son, Willis."
"Littlefinger brought you word?"
Tyrion leaned against the table.
"Not a master of whisperers? How interesting."
Cersei looked at their uncle in disbelief. "Sansa is my hostage. She goes nowhere without my leave."
"Leave, you must perforce grant, should Lord Tyrell ask," their father pointed out. "To refuse him would be tantamount to declaring that we did not trust him. He would take offence."
"Let him. What do we care?"
"Bloody fool," thought Tyrion. "Sweet sister," he explained patiently. "Offend Tyrell, and you offend Redwine, Tarly, Rowan, and Hightower as well, and perhaps start them wondering whether Robb Stark might not be more accommodating to their desires."
"I will not have the Rose and the Direwolf in bed together," declared Lord Tywin. "We must forestall him."
"How?"
asked Cersei.
"By marriage. Yours, to begin with."
It came so suddenly that Cersei could only stare for a moment. Then her cheeks reddened, as if she'd been slapped.
"No, not again. I will not."
"Your Grace," said Sir Kevin courteously, "you are a young woman, still fair and fertile. Surely you cannot wish to spend the rest of your days alone, and a new marriage would put to rest this talk of incest for good and all."
"So long as you remain unwed, you allow Stannis to spread his disgusting slander,"
Lord Tywin told his daughter.
"You must have a new husband in your bed to father children on you."
"Three children is quite sufficient. I am Queen of the Seven Kingdoms, not a broodmare, the Queen Regent."
"You are my daughter, and will do as I command."
She stood.
I will not sit here and listen to this. You will, if you wish to have any voice in the choice of your next husband, Lord Tywin said calmly. When she hesitated, then sat, Tyrion knew she was lost, despite her loud declaration of, I will not marry again.
You will marry, and you will breed. Every child you birth makes Stannis more a liar.
Their father's eyes seemed to pin her to a chair.
Mace Tyrell, Baxter Redwine, and Doran Martell are wed to younger women likely to outlive them. Balon Greyjoy's wife is elderly and failing, but such a match would commit us to an alliance with the Iron Islands, and I am still uncertain whether that would be our wisest course.
No, Cersei said between white lips. No, no, no. Tyrion could not quite suppress the grin that came to his lips at the thought of packing his sister off to Pike. Just when I was about to give up praying, some sweet god gives me this. Lord Tywin went on.
Oberyn Martell might suit, but the Tyrells would take that very ill. So, we must look to the sons. I assume you do not object to wedding a man younger than yourself.
I object to wedding any.
I have considered the Redwine twins, Theon Greyjoy, Quentin Martell, and a number of others. But our alliance with Highgarden was the sword that broke Stannis. It should be tempered and made stronger. Sir Loras has taken the White, and Sir Garland is wed to one of the Fosseways. But there remains the eldest son, the boy they scheme to wed to Sansa Stark.
Willis Tyrell?
Tyrion was taking a wicked pleasure in Cersei's helpless fury.
That would be the cripple, he said.
Their father chilled him with a look.
Willis is heir to Highgarden, and by all reports, a mild and courtly young man, fond of reading books and looking at the stars. He has a passion for breeding animals as well, and owns the finest hounds, hawks, and horses in the Seven Kingdoms.
A perfect match, mused Tyrion. Cersei also has a passion for breeding.
He pitied poor Willis Tyrell, and did not know whether he wanted to laugh at his sister or weep for her.
The Tyrell heir would be my choice, Lord Tywin concluded. But if you would prefer another, I will hear your reasons.
That is so very kind of you, father, Cersei said with icy courtesy. It is such a difficult choice you give me. Who would I sooner take to bed, the old squid or the crippled dog boy? I shall need a few days to consider. Do I have your leave to go?
You are the queen, Tyrion wanted to tell her. He ought to be begging leave of you.
Go, their father said. We shall talk again after you have composed yourself. Remember your duty.
Cersei swept stiffly from the room, her rage plain to see.
Yet in the end, she will do as father bid. She had proved that with Robert, though there is Jaime to consider.
Their brother had been much younger when Cersei wed the first time. He might not acquiesce to a second marriage quite so easily. The unfortunate Willis Tyrell was like to contract a sudden fatal case of sword through bowels, which could rather sour the alliance between Highgarden and Casterly Rock.
I should say something, but what? Pardon me, father, but it's her brother she wants to marry.
Tyrion?
He gave a resigned smile.
Do I hear the herald summoning me to the lists?
Your whoring is a weakness in you, Lord Tywin said without preamble. But perhaps some share of the blame is mine. Since you stand no taller than a boy, I have found it easy to forget that you are in truth a man grown, with all of a man's baser needs. It is past time you were wed.
I was wed, or have you forgotten? Tyrion's mouth twisted
and the noise emerged that was only half laugh and half snarl.
"Does the prospect of marriage amuse you?"
"Only imagining what a bugger-all handsome bridegroom I'll make." A wife might be the very thing he needed. If she brought him lands and a keep, it would give him a place in the world apart from Joffrey's court and away from Cersei and their father. On the other hand, there was Shay.
"She will not like this, for all she swears that she is content to be my whore."
That was scarcely a point to sway his father, however, so Tyrion squirmed higher in his seat and said,
"You mean to wed me to Sansa Stark? But won't the Tyrells take the match as an affront, if they have designs on the girl?"
"Lord Tyrell will not broach the matter of the Stark girl until after Joffrey's wedding. If Sansa's wed before that, how can he take offence, when he gave us no hint of his intentions?"
"Quite so," said Sir Kevin, "and any lingering resentments should be soothed by the offer of Cersei for his Willis." Tyrion rubbed at the raw stub of his nose. The scar tissue itched abominably sometimes.
"His Grace, the royal pustule, has made Sansa's life a misery since the day her father died. And now that she has finally rid of Joffrey, you propose to marry her to me? That seems singularly cruel, even for you, father."
"Why? Do you plan to mistreat her?"
His father sounded more curious than concerned.
"The girl's happiness is not my purpose, nor should it be yours. Our alliances in the south may be solid as costly rock, but there remains the north to win, and the key to the north is Sansa Stark."
"She is no more than a child."
"Your sister swears she's flowered. If so, she is a woman, fit to be wed. You must needs take her maidenhead, so no man can say the marriage was not consummated. After that, if you prefer to wait a year or two before bedding her again, you would be within your rights as her husband."
"Shay is all the woman I need just now," he thought, "and Sansa's a girl, no matter what you say."
"If your purpose here is to keep her from the Tyrells, why not return her to her mother? Perhaps that would convince Robb Stark to bend the knee."
Lord Tywin's look was scornful.
"Send her to River Run, and her mother will match her with a Blackwood or a Malister to shore up her son's alliances along the Trident. Send her north, and she will be wed to some Manderley or Umber before the moon turns. Yet she is no less dangerous here at court, as this business with the Tyrell should prove. She must marry a Lannister, and soon."
"The man who weds Sansa Stark can claim Winterfell in her name," his uncle Kevin put in. "Had that not occurred to you?"
"If you will not have the girl, we shall give her to one of your cousins," said his father. "Kevin, is Lancel strong enough to wed, do you think?"
Sir Kevin hesitated. "If we bring the girl to his bedside, he could say the words, but to consummate, no. I would suggest one of the twins, but the Starks hold them both at River Run. They have Jenna's boy, Tyrion, as well, else he might serve." Tyrion let them have their byplay. It was all for his benefit, he knew.
"Sansa Stark," he mused.
Soft-spoken, sweet-smelling Sansa, who loves silks, songs, chivalry, and tall, gallant knights with handsome faces. He felt as though he was back on the bridge of boats, the deck shifting beneath his feet.
"You have asked me to reward you for your efforts in the battle," Lord Tywin reminded him forcefully. "This is a chance for you, Tyrion, the best you're ever likely to have."
He drummed his fingers impatiently on the table.
"I once hoped to marry your brother to Lysa Tully, but Aerys named Jaime to his king's guard before the arrangements were complete. When I suggested to Lord Huster
that Lysa might be wed to you instead. He replied that he wanted a whole man for his daughter.
So he wed her to John Aaron, who was old enough to be her grandfather. Tirin was more inclined to be thankful than angry, considering what Lysa Aaron had become.
When I offered you to Dawn, I was told that the suggestion was an insult, Lord Tywin continued. In later years, I had similar answers from Jon Royce and Leighton Hightower. I finally stooped so low as to suggest you might take the Florent girl, Robert de Flard, in his brother's wedding bed. But her father preferred to give her to one of his own household knights. If you will not have the Stark girl, I shall find you another wife. Somewhere in the realm there is doubtless some little lordling who'd gladly part with a daughter to win the friendship of Casterly Rock. Lady Tender has offered lollies.
Tyrion gave a shudder of dismay.
I'd sooner cut it off and feed it to the goats.
Then open your eyes. The Stark girl is young, nubile, tractable, of the highest birth, and still a maid. She is not uncomely. Why would you hesitate?
Why, indeed? A quirk of mine. Strange to say, I would prefer a wife who wants me in her bed.
If you think your whores want you in their bed, you are an even greater fool than I suspected, said Lord Tywin. You disappoint me, Tyrion. I had hoped this match would please you.
Yes, we all know how important my pleasure is to you, Father. But there's more to this. The key to the North, you say. The Greyjoys hold the North now, and King Balin has a daughter. Why Sansa Stark, and not her? He looked into his father's cool green eyes with a bright flecks of gold. Lord Tywin steepled his fingers beneath his chin.
Balin Greyjoy thinks in terms of plunder, not rule. Let him enjoy an autumn crown and suffer a northern winter. He will give his subjects no cause to love him. Come spring, the Northmen will have had a bellyful of krakens. When you bring Eddard Stark's grandson home to claim his birthright, lords and little folk alike will rise as one to place him on the high seat of his ancestors. You are capable of getting a woman with child, I hope.
I believe I am, he said, bristling. I confess I cannot prove it, though no one can say I have not tried. Why, I plant my little seeds just as often as I can.
In the gutters and the ditches, finished Lord Tywin, and in common ground, where only bastard weeds take root. It is past time you kept your own garden.
He rose to his feet.
You shall never have Casterly Rock, I promise you. But wed Sansa Stark, and it is just possible that you might win a Winterfell.
Tyrion Lannister, Lord Protector of Winterfell. The prospect gave him a queer chill.
Very good, Father, he said slowly, but there's a big ugly roach in your rushes. Robb Stark is as capable as I am, presumably, and sworn to marry one of those fertile Freys. And once the young wolf sires a litter, any pups that Sansa births are heirs to nothing.
Lord Tywin was unconcerned.
Robb Stark will father no children on his fertile Frey, you have my word. There is a bit of news I have not yet seen fit to share with the council, though no doubt the good lords will hear it soon enough. The young wolf has taken Gawain Westerling's eldest daughter to wife.
For a moment Tyrion could not believe he'd heard his father right.
He broke his sworn word, he said incredulous. He threw away the phrase for...
Words failed him. A maid of 16 years named Jane, said Sir Kevin. Lord Gawain once suggested her to me for Willem or Martin, but I had to refuse him. Gawain is a good man, but his wife is Sybil Spicer. He should never have wed her. The Westlings always did have more honour than sense. Lady Sybil's grandfather was a trader in saffron and pepper, almost as low-born as that smuggler Stannis keeps. And the grandmother was some woman he'd brought back from the East, a frightening old crone, supposed to be a priestess. Meiji, they called her. No one could pronounce her real name. Half of Lannisport used to go to her for cures and love potions and the like. He shrugged. She is long dead, to be sure, and Jane seemed a sweet child, I'll grant you, though I only saw her once, but with such doubtful blood. Having once married a whore, Tyrion could not entirely share his uncle's horror at the thought of wedding a girl whose great-grandfather sold cloves. Even so, a sweet child, Sir Kevin had said, but many a poison was sweet as well. The Westlings were old blood, but they had more pride than power. It would not surprise him to learn that Lady Sybil had brought more wealth to the marriage than her high-born husband. The Westerling mines had failed years ago. Their best lands had been sold off or lost, and the crag was more ruin than stronghold. A romantic ruin, though, jutting up so brave above the sea. "I am surprised," Tyrion had to confess. "I thought Robb Stark had better sense."
"He's a boy of 16, said Lord Tywin. "At that age, sense weighs for little against lust and love and honour."
"He forswore himself, shamed an ally, betrayed a solemn promise. Where is the honour in that?" Sir Kevin answered. He chose the girl's honour over his own. Once he had deflowered her, he had no other course. "It would have been kinder to leave her with a bastard in her belly," said Tyrion bluntly. The Westlings stood to lose everything here, their lands, their castle, their very lives. A Lannister always pays his debts.
"Jane Westling is her mother's daughter," said Lord Tywin, "and Robb Stark is his father's son."
This Westling betrayal did not seem to have enraged his father as much as Tyrion would have expected. Lord Tywin did not suffer disloyalty in his vassals. He had extinguished the proud reigns of Castamere and the ancient Tarbecks of Tarbeck Hall, root and branch, when he was still half a boy. The singers had even made a rather gloomy song of it. Some years later, when Lord Farman of Faircastle grew truculent, Lord Tywin sent an envoy bearing a lute instead of a letter. But once he'd heard the reigns of Castamere echoing through his halls, Lord Farman gave no further trouble. And if the song were not enough, the shattered castles of the Reigns and Tarbecks still stood as mute testimony to the fate that awaited those who chose to scorn the power of Casterly Rock. "The crag is not so far from Tarbeck Hall and Castamere," Tyrion pointed out. "You'd think the Westlings might have ridden past and seen the lesson there."
"Mayhaps they have," Lord Tywin said. "They are well aware of Castamere, I promise you."
"Could the Westlings and Spicers be such great fools as to believe the wolf can defeat the lion?" Every once in a very long while, Lord Tywin Lannister would actually threaten to smile. He never did, but the threat alone was terrible to behold.
"The greatest fools are oft times more clever than the men who laugh at them," he said, and then, "You will marry Sansa Stark, Tyrion, and soon."
Brienne. East of Maidenpool the hills rose wild, and the pines closed in about them like a host of silent grey-green soldiers. Nimble Dick said the coast road was the shortest way, and the easiest, so they were seldom out of sight of the bay. The towns and villages along the shore grew smaller as they went and less frequent. At nightfall they would seek an inn. Crab would share the common bed with other travellers, whilst Brienne took a room for her and Podrick. cheaper if we all shared the same bed, m'lady, Nimble Dick would say. You could lay your sword between us. Old Dick's a harmless fella, chivalrous as a knight, and honest as the day is long. The days are growing shorter, Brian pointed out. Well, that may be. If you don't trust me in the bed, I could just curl up on the floor, m'lady. Not on my floor. A man might think you don't trust me none. Trust is earned, like gold. As you say, m'lady, said Crab, but up north, where the road gives out, you'll need to trust Dick then. If I wanted to take your gold at sword point, who's to stop me? You don't own a sword. I do. She shut the door between them and stood there listening until she was certain he had moved away. However nimble he might be, Dick Crabb was no Jamie Lannister, no Mad Mouse, not even a Humphrey Wagstaff. He was scrawny and ill-fed, his only armour a dinted half-helm spotted with rust. In place of a sword, he carried an old nicked dagger. So long as she was awake, he posed no danger to her. Podrick, she said, there will come a time when there are no more inns to shelter us. I do not trust our guide. When we make camp, can you watch over me as I sleep? Stay awake, my lady, sir, he thought. I have a sword. If Crab tries to hurt you, I could kill him. No, she said sternly. You were not to try and fight him. All I ask is that you watch him as I sleep, and wake me if he does anything suspicious. Awake quickly, you will find. Crab showed his true colours the next day when they stopped to water the horses. Brain had to step behind some bushes to empty her bladder. As she was squatting, she heard Podrick say, What are you doing? You get away from there! She finished her business, hiked up her breeches, and returned to the road to find Nimble Dick wiping flour off his fingers. You won't find any dragons in my saddlebags, she told him. I keep my gold upon my person. Some of it was in the pouch at her belt, the rest hidden in a pair of pockets sewn inside her clothing. The fat purse inside her saddlebags was filled with coppers, large and small, pennies and halfpennies, groats and stars, and fine white flour to make it fatter still. She had bought the flour from the cook at the Seven Swords the morning she rode out from Duskendale. Dick meant no harm, m'lady. He wriggled his flower-spotted fingers to show he held no weapon. I was only looking to see if you had these dragons, what you promised me. The world's full of liars, ready to cheat an honest man. Not that you're one. Brain hoped he was a better guide than he was a thief. We had best be going. She mounted up again. Dick would oft sing as they rode along together. Never a whole song, only a snatch of this and a verse of that. She suspected that he meant to charm her, to put her off her guard. Sometimes he would try to get her and Podrick to sing along with him, to no avail. The boy was too shy and tongue-tied, and Brian did not sing. "Did you sing for your father?" Lady Stark had asked her once at River Run. "Did you sing for Renly?" She had not ever, though she had wanted. She had wanted. When he was not singing, Nimble Dick would talk, regaling them with tales of Crackclaw Point. Every gloomy valley had its lord, he said, the lot of them united only by their mistrust of outsiders. In their veins the blood of the first men ran dark and strong. The Andals tried to take Crackclaw, but we bled them in the valleys and drowned them in the bogs. Only what their sons couldn't win with swords, their pretty daughters won with kisses. They married into the houses they couldn't conquer, aye. The Darkland kings of Duskendale had tried to impose their rule on Crackclaw Point. The Moutons of Maidenpool had tried as well, and later the haughty Celtigars of Crab Isle. But the Crackclaws knew their bogs and forests as no outsider could, and if hard pressed would vanish into the caverns that honeycombed their hills. When not fighting would-be conquerors, they fought each other. Their blood feuds were as deep and dark as the bogs between their hills. From time to time some champion would bring peace to the point, but it never lasted longer than his lifetime. Lord Lucifer Hardy, he was a great one, and the brothers Broon as well. Old Crackbones even more so, but the Crabs were the mightiest of all. Dick still still refused to believe that Brain had never heard of Sir Clarence Crabb and his exploits. "Why would I lie?" she asked him. "Every place has its local heroes. Where I come from, the singers sing of Sir Galadon of Morn, the perfect knight." "Sir Galahew of what?" he snorted. "Never heard of him. Why was he so bloody perfect?" Sir Galadon was a champion of such valour that the maiden herself lost her heart to him. She gave him an enchanted sword as a token of her love. The Just Maid, it was called. No common sword could check her, nor any shield withstand her kiss. Sir Galadon bore the Just Maid proudly, but only thrice did he unsheathe her. He would not use the maid against a mortal man, for she was so potent as to make any fight unfair. Crabb thought that was hilarious. "The perfect knight? The perfect fool, he sounds like. What's the point of having some magic sword if you don't bloody well use it?" "Honour," she said. "The point is honour." That only made him laugh the louder. "Sir Clarence Crabb would have wiped his hairy arse with your perfect knight, m'lady. If they'd ever have met, there'd be one more bloody head sitting on the shelf at the Whispers, you ask me. I should have used the magic sword," it'd be saying to all the other heads. "I should have used the bloody sword." Brain could not help but smile. "Perhaps," she allowed, "but Sir Galadon was no fool. Against a foe 8 feet tall, mounted on an aurochs, he might well have unsheathed the Just Maid. He used her once to slay a dragon, they say." Nimble Dick was unimpressed. "Crackbones fought a dragon too, but he didn't need no magic sword. He just tied its neck in a knot, so every time it breathed fire, it roasted its own arse." "And what did Crackbones do when Aegon and his sisters came?" Brain asked him. "He was dead. My lady must know that." Crabb gave her a sideways look. "Aegon sent his sister up to Crackclaw, that Visenya. The lords had heard of Harren's end. Being no fools, they laid their swords at her feet. The queen took them as her own men, and said they'd owe no fealty to Maidenpool, Crab Isle, or Duskendale. Don't stop them bloody Celtigars from sending men to the eastern shore to collect his taxes. If he sends enough, a few come back to him. Elsewise, we bow only to our own lords and the king. The true king, not Robert and his ilk." He spat. "There was Crabs and Brunes and Boggses with Prince Rhaegar on the Trident and in the King's Guard, too. A Hardy, a Cave, a Pine, and 3 Crabs, Clement and Rupert and Clarence the Short. 6 foot tall he was, but short compared to the real Sir Clarence. We're all good dragon men up Crackclaw way." The traffic continued to dwindle as they moved north and east, until finally there were no inns to be found. By then the Bayside Road was more weeds than ruts. That night they took shelter in a fishing village. Brain paid the villagers a few coppers to allow them to bed down in a hay barn. She claimed the loft for Podrick and herself and pulled the ladder up after them. "You leave me down here alone, I could bloody well steal your horses," Crabb called up from below. "Best you get them up the ladder too, m'lady." When she ignored him, he went on to say, "It's going to rain tonight. A cold, hard rain. You and Pods will sleep all snug and warm, and poor old Dick will be shivering down here by myself." He shook his head, muttering, as he made a bed on a pile of hay, "I never knew such a mistrustful maid as you." Brain curled up beneath her cloak, with Podrick yawning at her side. "I was not always wary," she might have shouted down at Crabb. "When I was a little girl, I believed that all men were as noble as my father. Even the men who told her what a pretty girl she was, how tall and bright and clever, how graceful when she danced. It was Septa Roel who had lifted the scales from her eyes. They only say those things to win your lord father's favour," the woman had said. "You'll find truth in your looking-glass, not on the tongues of men." It was a harsh lesson, one that left her weeping, but it had stood her in good stead at Harrenhal when Sir Hyle and his friends had played their game. "A maid has to be mistrustful in this world, or she will not be a maid for long," she was thinking as the rain began to fall. In the melee at Bitterbridge, she had sought out her suitors and battered them one by one, Farrow and Ambrose and Bushy, Mark Mullendore and Raymond Nayland and Will the Stork. She had ridden over Harry Sawyer and broken Robin Potter's helm, giving him a nasty scar. And when the last of them had fallen, the mother had delivered Connington to her. This time Sir Runnet held a sword, and not a rose. Every blow she dealt,